Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story is part two of a two-part presentation on the story of Yosuke Frank Matsuoka, the waterfront Portland errand boy who grew up to be the foreign minister of Imperial Japan just before World War II, which in turn is part of a sequence of six related episodes, walking through the literally earth-shaking events that resulted from a seemingly minor bit of Portland waterfront lawbreaking in the early 1890s. This is the sixth and final episode on this topic. Today we finish our run through this remarkable story and contemplate what might have been. Here we go. Yosuke Matsuoka was only foreign minister for about a year. But it was a hell of a year. From the start, his goal was to forge an official alliance with Nazi Germany. He was convinced that only as a partner with Germany could Japan negotiate on an equal footing with its greatest rival, the United States, and he hoped that the treaty would be spun as a failure for the Roosevelt administration, which he didn't like. This would cause Roosevelt, hopefully, to lose the 1940 election. Matsuoka had given up on ever being able to do business with Roosevelt's people. They were too intransigently opposed to Japan's occupation of Manchuria, which he considered an indispensable lifeline of raw materials for the island empire. A new administration under Wendell Willkie would, he hoped, be eager to break from the old regime, and perhaps with the right kind of diplomacy, it could be brought around to Japan's way of thinking. Then the U.S. could broker a peace with honor deal for both China and Japan. Both countries had been bogged down in a shooting war stalemate in Manchuria for half a decade, and then everybody could settle down again. The problem was, Matsuoka thought he understood America and Americans, when in fact what he understood was the rough-and-tumble waterfront districts and lumber camps of 1890s Portland and Oregon. He thought of Americans as a bluff, straightforward bunch who despised weakness but respected guts and strength. He also thought of them as not being too hung up on things like anti-smuggling laws. The sheer audacity of the Blum Dunbar gang's opium operations had commanded respect in Portland. Matsuoka naturally thought Americans would respond positively to similar kinds of audacity played out on the international stage. But America in 1940 was completely unlike waterfront Portland in 1893. In fact, throughout the late 1930s, Oregon raconteur Stuart Holbrook made a good living pumping old retired waterfront thugs for stories of those crazy old days and publishing them in the Morning Oregonian for modern readers, I mean modern 1935 readers, to shake their heads over in amazement at how much different their world had become and how crazy it had been back then. Matsuoka was a living anachronism, and his confidence in his understanding of the country he spent his teenage years in was about to bite him and his country really hard. But that's getting a little ahead of our story. When Yosuke Matsuoka accepted his appointment as Imperial Japan's foreign minister, it was the fulfillment of a dream for him. The gregarious 13-year-old boy who had been informally adopted into Portland opium smuggler William Dunbar's household back in 1893 had come a long way in the following 47 years. He'd become a national hero in Japan. He was by far the single most famous Japanese person in the world internationally, and almost certainly the most famous University of Oregon alumnus. It should have been a triumphal time for him. And while it did have its moments, Matsuoka's time in the chair as Japan's top diplomat was a real pivot point in his life. The mistakes he made as foreign minister, crucial strategic mistakes that came disguised as big foreign policy triumphs, would define Matsuoka and his legacy forever. And mostly not in a good way. Although my interpretation of the events of his life probably goes a ways towards rehabilitating that reputation. But the first of these terrible things, and the biggest, was the pact with Nazi Germany, the Tripartite Pact. This pact was officially signed on September 19, 1940, bringing Japan officially and irrevocably into the Axis. Japan was now, for better or for much worse, an ally of Nazi Germany. And this was all Matsuoka's pet project. This was his plan. Nobody else was pushing this. It was all Yosuke Matsuoka. What he found, though, was that instead of respecting Japan's resolve and working to defuse tensions to prevent getting drawn into a two-front war, the Americans got alarmed, sensing that they were being closed in on. Instead of sending Roosevelt packing as punishment for allowing the setback to occur, they rallied around him and started getting ready for the upcoming fight. Instead of making it harder for Roosevelt to sell assistance to England to the American public, the pact made it easier. There was something else that Matsuoka did, too, that he soon bitterly regretted, although it was one of the most signal diplomatic masterstrokes of his career. In April of 1941, while visiting Adolf Hitler in Berlin, he induced Hitler to do a little bragging and get carried away while talking about what Germany might do in a war with the U.S.
Germany would wage a vigorous war against America with U-boats and the Luftwaffe and with her greater experience,
he assured Matsuoka. Sorry, I gotta use a bad German accent when I'm quoting Hitler.
This would be more than a match for America.
And that is when he said it. And this is what he said. This one line changed world history. Right here.
If Japan gets into a conflict with the United States, Germany on her part will take the necessary steps at once.
That was really important. Japan now had the personal pledge of the head of the German state that if war came, they would back them up. People have wondered for years what the hell the Germans were thinking declaring war on the U.S. after Pearl Harbor. Well, this is why. This is why they did it. Because Hitler said he would. So yeah, very important. And with that, of course, they had his pledge. But this was also a sword that cut two ways. It turned Japan into a tripwire that the Roosevelt administration could tug on to bring their reluctant country to the aid of the beleaguered British. Now, as far as I know, there isn't any direct evidence that Roosevelt's people started tugging on that tripwire. But given the circumstances, it would be contrary to human nature and the nature of diplomacy if they didn't do exactly that. And Matsuoka clearly thought they were doing so in the months that followed. Well, after that, Matsuoka's tenure as foreign minister was not long. It ended 3 months later, in July of 1941. Convinced that the U.S. was trying to bait Japan into war, he'd become something of a loose cannon and had lost the confidence of Army Minister General Hideki Tojo, who by now was the real power in the Japanese government. Prime Minister Konoe accordingly dissolved the cabinet and reformed it without Matsuoka in it. Konoe's government only lasted a few months after that. Tensions with the United States got worse and worse, Tojo got more and more bellicose, and finally in October, Konoe took the hint and resigned. He was replaced with Tojo, and of course Tojo took the country straight to war, taking special care to make sure that the Nazis would back Japan up, as their Führer had pledged to do, and as, of course, they did. On the morning of the Pearl Harbor attack, Matsuoka heard the news on the radio like everyone else. Initially, he was exhilarated, but a day later, the situation had sunk in a bit more.
The Tripartite Pact was my worst mistake, he told a visitor. I had hoped to prevent the United States from entering the war.
Matsuoka spent the war years struggling with the tuberculosis that would shortly kill him. By the time the two atomic bombs had been detonated on Japanese soil, he was in obvious decline. But he hadn't given up. Despite the bleak outlook for his country, he got involved with a plan to form an underground resistance government. He believed the remains of the Japanese army could hold out for 10 years on a guerrilla basis. America had all the strength, he admitted, but he claimed not the patience. A quote-unquote third-rate politician like President Truman would not be able to inspire his rabbly democratic masses to put up with a 10-year struggle to subdue Japan, and they would win by attrition. Of course, there might be a few more nuclear bombings in the meantime, but, you know, eggs, omelets, he thought they could tolerate those. But it was not to be. The emperor, when he caught wind of this plan, put his foot down. That was it. That was enough. We're done. And so the war ended with Japan utterly supine. Matsuoka nearly on his deathbed. He finally succumbed to his tuberculosis in age 66 in June of 1946, while in prison awaiting trial on war crimes charges. Yosuke Matsuoka was a product of his time. But more than that, he was a product of another time and another place, of the late 19th century in one of the roughest, least refined parts of the American frontier, the Shanghaiing-era Portland waterfront. And it showed. Just after the war's end, a Japanese reporter asked him what Americans were like. This was his response.
No assuming, you are walking on a small path in a field, which is so narrow that only one person can pass through, and an American comes from the opposite direction, he said. You are facing each other, and neither side is willing to yield his right of way. Soon becoming impatient, the American will clench his fist and sock you in the jaw. Taken by surprise, you may lower your head and let him pass by. Next time you meet him on the same path, he will simply raise his fist. He considers that the best solution. On the other hand, he continued, if you do not retreat the first time and engage a counterattack, the American will be shocked and will take another look at you. Well, this fellow knows what he is doing. So recognizing, he will become your best friend.
Responding to this quote, David Liu, Matsoka's biographer, writes, this was the America of cowboys, of confrontations at high noon, and of the Wild West. And this image of the bygone era acquired in the still underdeveloped Pacific Northwest was to govern Matsoka's thinking when he negotiated with the United States. As evidenced by the fact that he was still thinking this way in 1945 after it was all over and his punch the cowboy and he will become your pal strategy had failed again and again and again, Matsoka never really learned this lesson. And yet, is it possible the crafty old diplomat was actually right? Certainly not in his own lifetime, but in ours, Japan has become many Americans' favorite foreign country. In fact, according to Gallup's annual World Affairs poll, 82% of Americans regard Japan mostly favorably or very favorably. This puts Japan in fourth place behind France at 84%, Britain at 86%, and Canada at 87%. As the rawness of the wounds of the war has faded to a memory, a certain admiration and respect for an uncommonly gutsy old adversary remains. In fact, the relationship between Japan and the U.S. today actually seems pretty analogous to that cowboy and his new best friend sitting side by side at the bar in an old West saloon, each with a black eye and a bloody nose, having a beer together. There's something else Matsoka was long-term right about, too. And this is where the story actually gets a little spooky. It was a famous speech that he gave in Geneva in 1931 as the League of Nations debated what to do about the Manchuria incident. Remember, that was the false flag dynamite attack and an invasion by rogue Japanese army officers. Matsoka stood before the world on that day, and this is what he said.
Humanity crucified Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago, he declaimed. And today, can any of you assure me that the so-called world opinion can make no mistake? We Japanese feel we are now put on trial. Some of the people in Europe and America may even wish to crucify Japan in the 20th century. Gentlemen, Japan stands ready to be crucified. But we do believe, and firmly believe, that in a very few years, world opinion will be changed, and that we shall also be understood by the world as Jesus of Nazareth was.
By the way, I'm sorry about my Scottish accent. I know it's terrible. I don't really know how to do one, but I had to do something. Anyway, the speech. It was not well received, especially by serious Christians who felt it was borderline blasphemy, if not worse. But in Japan, it was a sensation. Translations were printed and distributed, and the speech was used in schools' English language programs alongside Shakespeare. A phonograph record of it was made and sold in shops. And again, looking back on that speech from 1945, it must have looked like that had been a lot of hot air, liberally spiced with bitter irony. Japan had been crucified indeed, and on a cross of uranium. And for what? But by 1962, it actually made some sense. In fact, if somebody had brought it to Nikita Khrushchev's attention during the Cuban Missile Crisis, after he had made the conscious decision to let himself be basically ousted as leader of the Soviet Union by reaching past the big red button on his desk and picking up the phone instead, a decision that has to have been influenced by the spectacle of Japan's burning cities and radiation-ravaged people and the gut-wrenching journalism of John Hersey and his eyewitness account of Hiroshima after the bomb, and all of those newsreels, maybe Khrushchev would have understood and agreed with Matsoka's statement. It is entirely possible, if not likely, that Japan's nuclear sacrifice saved the world from nuclear holocaust 17 years later. The argument goes like this. Hiroshima became a sacrificial lamb on that day. A few days later, Nagasaki became another, giving the world a small taste of what nuclear holocaust might look like in the era of multi-megaton hydrogen bombs. After seeing the film footage, reading the eyewitness accounts, no one would ever be able to think of nuclear war in a purely abstract term again. No one would ever be able to hold national pride in one hand and thermonuclear war in the other and think for one red-hot second that they were of similar value. That's a gift that the whole world received in 1945, paid for in full with the blood of Japanese innocents. The gift they bequeathed us was a visceral demonstration of why such weapons must never be used again. And we may never know if we owe those innocents our own lives, but it sure seems likely, doesn't it? So maybe, just maybe, just probably, if you ask me, we would all be dead today and our beautiful planet a charred and smoking radioactive cinder if it hadn't been for an incompetent drug smuggler on the old Shanghaiing area Portland waterfront taking an orphan boy into his household 130 years ago. And if that's not the butterfly effect, I'd just love to know what is. Key sources in this story have included works by David J. Liu, Anu Masaharu, and Megan Brennan. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.